The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Anushka Astana. Theresa May has done a deal with a DUP, but what exactly has the government got for its £1 billion down payment? And will the DUP be coming back for more? It certainly did not go down well among the SNP, who want more money for Scotland. But in the meantime, have they kicked their independence referendum demand into the long grass? We will hear from their new Westminster leader, Ian Blackford.
I'm a different personality from Angus. I've got masses of respect for him, but I hope people will judge me on my ability to be a strong voice for Scotland in this Parliament.
Plus, I've been in Wales with the Bank of England's chief economist on the first stop of a new tour, listening to how interest rates and inflation affect real lives.
All my money's gone on renting instead of savings for deposit for mortgages, despite having the money there. It's just the instability around job security, really.
And we'll hear from two MPs who lost their seats in 2015, only to happily return this month.
It was surreal. I did not expect to be back in this place in such a short timescale.
Joining me for all this, I have the historian and political journalist Andy Beckett, commentator Ellie Mae O'Hagan, and the former Conservative policy wonk turned think tanker Sean Worth. Now, Sean, you were in Downing Street during the coalition years in which the Lib Dems were bound formally in an agreement to the Conservatives. That deal lasted 5 years. What do you make of this one?
This is a confidence and supply deal. So it's very, very different from a formal coalition. There'll be no shared manifesto, no programme for government and all of that. So it's very limited. How long it lasts is going to be the interesting thing. I think it should be okay. DUP backed the government on some quite strong measures last night in the debate in the House of Commons, where Labour tried to push through ideas for removing the cap on public sector pay, for example. The Tory party and other parties actually have worked with the DUP for a long time. And while Theresa May had a small majority government, she had to work with the DUP a lot. And that went reasonably well. The DUP are steeped in sectarian politics and brinkmanship, and that's why it looked like they may or may not support her in the run-up to this. But that's frankly, that's what they always do. I mean, as far as I know them, they've always done that. So I think it'll be fairly stable, to be honest.
Okay, and Ellie, the Daily Mirror has described them as crackpots, and that's partly because of their socially conservative views. But look, this is all about money, isn't it? It's £1 billion extra for one of the poorest parts of the UK. Do you find yourself thinking you could maybe support that?
Well, I've opposed austerity since 2010 and I'm from Wales, and I feel like we could do with £1 billion to help us out, given that we have some of the poorest regions in Europe. But look, the thing that annoys me about this agreement, the thing I find really frustrating, is that at least in 2010, we knew who the Lib Dems were. We knew who Nick Clegg was. We kind of vaguely knew what they stood for. But most people in this country, of course, people in Northern Ireland are very familiar with the DUP. But most people in mainland Britain, they don't even know who they are. In fact, I tweeted words to that effect the other day, and I got replies from lots of people saying they thought that Arlene Foster was the judge on Strictly Come Dancing. I don't think that most...
Similar name.
Yeah. I don't think that most people knew who they were. I don't think that they knew that this agreement was even a possibility. I think this has been one of the most unscrutinised agreements that I've seen in my political lifetime, and that is quite scandalous.
And the problem there is that this is a party that isn't a national party like the Lib Dems, so you're saying people knew them less, although the people in Northern Ireland might say they knew the Lib Dems less. I mean, does that mean, for example, that Labour could never do a deal with the SNP?
No, I think people are much more familiar with the SNP than they are with the DUP, certainly after the 2015 election. But I just wanted to pick up on what you said about social conservatism, because, you know, one thing that really worries me is the DUP's stance on abortion. And I want to know what has been said behind closed doors about abortion. What have there been any guarantees made to the DUP on that? Has Theresa May said that she won't change abortion laws in this country? And because, frankly, I feel if that hasn't been brought up, that's negligent. Women die because of tight abortion laws. There are currently women on trial in Northern Ireland over abortion. And the fact that we've gone into a deal with this party without discussing things like that, I think is quite scandalous, really.
And Sean, you're shaking your head, and clearly they have said they're not going to touch those areas, but this is what they think.
The DUP have always been a presence in Westminster politics, and they are not running the country. It's as simple as that. It is a confidence and supply deal. They're not any bigger part in running the country than they always have been. The one area of scrutiny that you should have is about this chunk of money that they've got. And the justification for giving them more money, exactly in your logic, is that the Northern Ireland is the poorest region in the UK. About 25% of people there live in pretty dire
if that
poverty.
Was, sorry, Sean, but if that was the justification, then you could give that money at any point. There clearly had to be a sweetener here in order for the DUP to offer
that.
The confidence
totally
and supply
that.
Deal. And actually, Andy, one of the things that Ellie picked up on is that she's from Wales, and the backlash that we've seen from Wales, from Scotland, partly because this money is going above the Barnett formula, so therefore won't have an implication for the rest of the country, has frustrated people. I mean, is that backlash going to come back and bite Theresa May?
I think it could well do. I think something the Conservatives need to think about is their 13 seats in Scotland could actually be a bit of a poison chalice, because I think those seats are going to be very hard to hold at any future general election, especially if people in Scotland are feeling hard done by about what's happening with public spending in Ulster. Yeah, so I think it could potentially be a big problem for them.
And Ruth Davidson came out very hard on this. She made the argument that Scotland has had money outside of Barnett, for example, £500 million for Glasgow as a city deal. Do you think she almost came out too hard, that that might make people in Scotland feel she's not, you know, fighting their corner?
I think she's got quite a difficult game to play, partly because her position, she's got this sort of inflated political support in Scotland, but it might be a kind of passing thing. So I think she's quite vulnerable in all kinds of ways. A question I have about the deal, which we've not discussed yet, is the connections between the DUP and paramilitary violence in Ulster in the past. And I think it's a bit rich for the Conservative press, who were utterly obsessed by Jeremy Corbyn and his supposed links to the IRA and republicanism, to basically not mention the DUP's own pretty dark history in this area.
And Ellie, presumably you find that quite frustrating, not just the fact that they're doing a deal with one side of an argument, you know, which some people feel might make the Belfast agreement weaker, but secondly, this is the coalition of chaos that they hammered Jeremy Corbyn with throughout the entire election campaign.
I suppose what I find frustrating on a bigger picture level is that during the election campaign and in the run-up to it, a narrative really took hold in the press that Labour was going to be a disaster, that the Tories would win by a landslide, and that Theresa May would end up with a massive majority, and that Jeremy Corbyn was this kind of dangerous anti-British guy who couldn't be trusted and no one would vote for him. And what I find frustrating about that is, because that narrative was so dominant, it's meant that there's been no investigation of the people who are voting for Labour, why they're voting for Labour. There's been no scrutiny over the DUP and this agreement. There's been no kind of survey of any of the possible outcomes of the election other than a huge Tory landslide. And I feel that the press and the kind of apparatus that surrounds it really failed in its duty in this election, because it became so taken over by this narrative, and it's meant that the whole election is actually very unscrutinised.
And Sean, do you think that's a fair point?
I do, but for different reasons. I would have loved the election to scrutinise policy in particular a lot more, because, for example, Jeremy Corbyn's tax and spend policies didn't really get much of a raking through. But in the defence of the media, there were two terrorist attacks, and if you talk to political editors, they'll tell you that, you know, item one on the news was usually something to do with the terror, and then the campaign was second. And normally you give two slots of campaign. First, what they're doing, where they're going, and who they're shouting at in their megaphone or whatever. And then you go raking through the policies. And the second item couldn't really get the space that it should have had. So I think there was a defence for the media on that.
I think also there wasn't that much raking through the policies because the Conservatives didn't offer that many policies. I think that was a flaw in the Conservative campaign. Labour offered a lot of policies, yep, which we can maybe say were a bit rickety, but the Conservative manifesto was pretty policy light. There wasn't much to discuss.
I'm going to take a moment to defend The Guardian, because I'm not going to speak for any other papers, and say that one of the things we did very deliberately, and in fact, I even predicted a hung parliament on this very podcast early on in the campaign, was we didn't actually put the polls at the top of any of the stories. And we made a very deliberate effort not to do that. Now, Jeremy Corbyn fans have their frustrations with The Guardian. I understand that completely. But the aim of what we wanted to do was to try to focus actually on the policies. And I think we did, for example, scrutinise the social care stuff incredibly strongly through the campaign. That doesn't mean that there are no mea culpas. There are after every campaign. And aren't they just? Andy wrote this fascinating piece this week about the Tories, who have this reputation as being brilliant election winners and, in fact, have failed to win an election in any convincing manner since 1987. That is 30 years. Andy, what are they doing wrong?
One of the main things I think they've done wrong, and they've done increasingly since the 92 election when they won narrowly and unexpectedly by going very negative, is they've become addicted to negative campaigning. And it's often associated with Linton Crosby, the Australian political consultant who's been involved in a lot of their recent campaigns. But I think it goes deeper than that. I think the Conservative Party egged on by the right-wing press, thinks that if it monsters Labour sufficiently, that's enough to win elections. And I think that's a very useful thing to do from their point of view, and it's quite effective, but it probably doesn't get you to big majorities. And when Thatcher was running elections in the late 70s and the 80s, there was a nasty negative side, but there was also a big positive offer about mass shareholding, property-owning democracy, all that kind of stuff. And I think the Conservatives have become too negative. I think also they've kind of lost their curiosity about Britain and how it's changing. So the kind of urban liberal middle classes, who are now enormous because so many more people go to university, Conservatives don't really have a lot to say to them, and they're not massively interested. When I talk to Conservatives and say, what have you got to say to people like my neighbours in Hackney, who are very wealthy private sector people who all vote Labour, they're kind of a bit baffled. All they say, oh, they're just a few Guardian readers, we don't need to worry about them. And I think there's a kind of incuriosity about British society in Conservative campaigning now, whereas Conservatives in the 70s and the 80s were very, very interested in Britain and how it was changing and how they could kind of go with the grain of that. And I think so the kind of positive offer and the negative side have kind of got out of balance. And so they can still scrape wins every now and again, but really big wins, which they always used to get for 150 years prior to 87, they've kind of stopped getting.
Okay, and one thing that I was very interested in the campaign, Ellie, both at Jeremy rallies that I saw during this election campaign, but during his second leadership campaign, was the number of public sector workers that you often found. And in fact, some Tory MPs said to me, they met people who hadn't voted for them and they came out and they said, why? And they said, well, I'm a nurse. And that was literally all they had to say. Now, in truth, the Tories were 5 points behind Labour with public sector workers, but that's still pretty big. Do you think the Conservatives made a really big mistake by not supporting Labour's amendment on the public sector pay cap?
Yeah, absolutely. I think as well the public is growing tired of public sector cuts. You know, I think sympathy, the British Social Attitude Survey came out this week, and it showed that sympathy for people on benefits is at its highest for years. I think the tide is turning away from public sector cuts now, and I think it was a huge mistake on their part not to support that amendment. I think they will have put off a lot of public sector workers already. I mean, I know lots of people who work in the public sector, and the constant cutting, the stress, the long hours is really starting to grind them down, and I can't see how this will have helped.
And Sean, very quickly on that, surely it is the time to loosen austerity further and lift that cap.
I do agree with that. I agree, especially for nurses and NHS workers. I don't think you can lift a public sector pay cap across the board in the current system where you have national pay bargaining, for example. You do have to look at reform. I don't want to get into boring technical stuff unless you want me to. But, you know, the fact that you can get paid the same in an area of very low living standards as you can somewhere else is just... it's not fair on the people that work in the public sector, and it just does. I mean, it's a function of the fact that the public sector is run by the trade unions, and they resist all forms of progressive kind of reform like that. Unfortunately, you could really do something exciting with public sector pay and rewards, especially for frontline workers. But in the current system, yeah, you need to package it with reform.
Well, there is plenty more on our website at theguardian.com/politics. Well, it's not just the Tories who had their fingers burnt at the election. The SNP lost their former leader, Alex Salmond, and their Westminster leader, Angus Robertson. The party is now led in the Commons by Ian Blackford, who spoke to me earlier. So I'm in Westminster, joined by the new SNP leader. And I suppose the first obvious question is, how do you feel about that DUP deal for Theresa May?
Well, we're outraged because what we've got is a situation where the United Kingdom government is playing off one part of the UK against another. We're not against the investment in Northern Ireland. Indeed, we welcome it. The fact that there's £1 billion that's going into the economy there. But this should be done under the Barnett consequential rules. Even the Secretary of State for Scotland, David Mundell, was making that very point at the weekend. And if that were the case, under these rules, we'd be looking at an investment in public services and infrastructure in Scotland of up to £2.9 billion. Incidentally, equivalent to the cuts to the Scottish budget that was seen over the last few years under the Tories. So it would be a very significant response to the austerity programme of the government. If you look at what's happening specifically in Northern Ireland, there's a 20% uplift to their infrastructure investment. That would would make an enormous difference if we had such opportunities in Scotland, lead to an increase in productivity, build capacity in the economy. And I'll certainly be seeking to hold the government to account and calling on the Scottish Secretary to make sure that he's standing up for our interests. Or quite frankly, one would question, what is the role of the Secretary of State? Is he there to represent the Cabinet in Scotland, or will he join with us in standing up in our national interest? Or if not, frankly, I think he needs to look at his own position.
Okay, and you're here to represent the voters in Scotland. Yeah. One of the things that's clearly been a huge issue for voters in Scotland is that they voted to remain in the EU, which means Brexit is going to be extremely important. Theresa May has lost her majority that she was seeking that mandate for. How do you now exploit that and try to push Parliament towards a softer Brexit?
Well, we're in a very different place than where we were a few weeks ago. And let's remember that the Prime Minister called this election on anticipation of getting a landslide. She has failed miserably in that. She's had a bloody nose. I would argue there is no majority in Parliament for a hard Brexit. And I think it's important that those of us that are concerned about the possibility of going off the cliff edge are able to argue that we need to make sure that we protect the interests of Scotland, England, Wales and Northern Ireland. We accept that the UK has voted to come out of the EU, but there certainly wasn't a decision to come out of the single market and the customs union. And we'll be arguing that we need to protect investment, jobs, living standards, and we do that by staying within the single market.
And we were talking on another issue about a independence referendum by the spring of 2019. We're now going to return to this subject not before the autumn of 2018. Many people saying you're kicking it into the long grass. Why is that?
No, it's not been kicked into the long grass. I think really what we're reflecting on is the circumstances that we're now living in, that we know there's an opportunity to protect the interest of Scotland in particular through the Brexit talks to be an alternative to austerity. We want to demonstrate that we can act in the national interest on these matters. What the Scottish Government has is a mandate from the Scottish Parliament election last year to have a referendum on a change of circumstances. Now, I hope that we can protect the Scottish interest over the course of the next 18-month period. If not, it is the case that any independence referendum is an insurance policy against coming off that cliff edge. And we want to make sure the people of Scotland have that opportunity, just as indeed every member state of the EU will have on any Brexit deal.
But if it's not a cliff, if it's a nice, gentle hill and we end up still as members of the single market, for example, one of your key demands, would you say, okay, in that case, let's forget independence for now?
The test would be a change of circumstances, and I think if we can protect the economic interests of the people of Scotland, then of course we would reflect on that. The SNP is the party of independence, and we wish to see Scotland becoming an independent state at some point in the future, but it's the circumstances of at the time that will determine that.
And you step into some pretty big shoes. Angus Robertson was quite a figure here in Parliament, of course lost his seat, very well known for his very serious PMQs appearances. Often people argued that he was one of the best and most effective people in the chamber. How are you going to compare?
Well, Angus will be missed. He'll be missed by me, he'll be missed by our colleagues, and certainly I think he will be missed in the House. I'm a different personality from Angus. I've got masses of respect for him, but I hope people will judge me on my ability to be a strong voice for Scotland in this Parliament.
And just finally, remarkable that today in Westminster Hall, Jeremy Corbyn met by his backbench MP singing Jeremy Corbyn, you know, the chant was out. It's remarkable how things change in here. Is he someone you could work with?
I will happily work with anybody in this House to make sure that we can get a better deal for the people of Scotland, both on Brexit and on austerity, and I rule nobody out from that.
The SNP's new Westminster leader, Ian Blackford, there. Now, the Bank of England has gone on tour. Well, its chief economist, Andy Haldane, has. He's embarking on a series of visits that will eventually take him or colleagues to every county in the country, speaking not just to businesses, as the bank has long done, but to ordinary folk, to listen to what interest rate decisions and the inflationary impact they have mean for everyday lives. I spent a very interesting day with him in location number one, which happened to be in Wales because the bank represents the whole of the UK. And at a number of community centres, we heard people, young and old, very worried about the cost of living.
The energy giants are making millions, and yet the cost of our energy is going up and up and up. Why?
Going onto the housing market, mortgages is something I'm really worried about, in the sense that at the moment I'm renting, which I feel is putting money into an empty pot, and I'm not really getting anything back for it. So all my money's gone on renting instead of savings for deposit for mortgages, despite having the money there. It's just instability around job security, really.
And good to tell the Bank of England chief economist that.
Yeah, and he's really responsive. It was really interesting and sort of empowering to know that people in his sort of position are coming to places like the ELU community to speak to us. So it's fantastic.
So we've just finished in a community centre by the biggest housing estate in Wales. Is this the first time you've done something like this?
So the bank has had a regional network around the country for many decades, actually, typically meeting companies, mostly companies, figuring out what's happening. You know, are they spending? Are they hiring? How are their orders? All that sort of stuff that feeds back into our deliberations on monetary policy and interest rates and all that good stuff. But increasingly, over the last year or two in particular, we've sought to broaden a bit the set of people we speak to about how the economy is going. So that increasingly includes charities, not-for-profits, community groups, faith groups, trade unions, to getting that, you know, wide-angle lens on how the economy is doing, and looking at the economy through very different lenses, the centre we've just come from, a very different set of issues than those you typically pick up from a CEO.
Well, can I ask you about some of those issues? So pretty much everyone around the table raised the cost of living to such an extent that one gentleman, Alan, actually said he was coming across people who were essentially imposing austerity on themselves, for example, not paying to go for their children to go on a school trip. Is that a picture that you recognise?
I mean, it's certainly a message that you hear right round the country. And it's a combination, as you say, of the cost of living having gone up, which it plainly has, largely a result of, you know, the pound having fallen last year. So we've seen prices in the shops go up pretty rapidly. At the same time as people's pay hasn't much moved. So, and I think we heard a lot about that today. This expression that was used, as you say, struck with me too, self-imposed austerity, which is, if you like, people cutting back on investing in themselves or in their family, that was a worrying thing to hear. I mean, how generalised that is, it's tough to know, because these are just individual stories and anecdotes. Even the words financial capability or financial literacy or the economy or GDP or even inflation, you ask people, they haven't got the faintest idea what it means most of the time. You know, you carry out surveys and, I don't know, 1 in 10 people might know what GDP means. 1 in 8 might know what inflation is. Only about 1 in 4 have some understanding of what the bank's talking about most of the time. So there is a understanding gap, an understanding deficit, and I think that has an impact on people's willingness to trust economists like me or institutions like the bank. So whether it's their own financial planning for a pension, for the world of work, for a mortgage, for a deposit account, or whether it's the world of policy, how's the economy doing? Is GDP going up, down, or sideways? I think everyone stands to be somewhat better off if they are somewhat better informed about how that works. And part of that does fall to the curriculum. And one of the big pushes, big priorities for the bank this year will be working on some educational initiatives. I take very seriously our responsibilities as a public authority to explain not just our own actions, but more broadly how the economy works. And what better way than to have this as part of the curriculum? I hope that would be good news for people making their decisions about all those things I mentioned, and for us when making decisions about policy.
Well, back now in the studio with my guests, and in a sign of how surreal politics has got recently, tens of thousands of people at the Glastonbury Music Festival gathered at the main stage at the weekend to hear a short speech from Jeremy Corbyn.
You brought the spirit of music, you brought the spirit of love, you brought the spirit of ideas, and you brought the spirit of great messages. And if you can see that far, look on the wall right over there that surrounds this wonderful festival. And there's a message on that wall for President Donald Trump. And you know what it says? Build bridges, not walls.
What's going on here, Ellie? You know, what do you think drove that? And do you think Jeremy was right to go to Glastonbury?
Yeah, I found all of the sort of hand-wringing over whether he was right to go to Glastonbury or not kind of odd. It's a crowd of 200,000 people. It was getting broadcast on the BBC across the country. Of course he should take that platform. Why wouldn't he? I mean, I doubt that Theresa May would be invited, but if she was, I would think it would be entirely sensible for her.
What do you think she'd say on the pyramid stage?
This is a strong and stable stage. And in terms of the chant, I think what's happened with Corbyn is that the way that his supporters have been portrayed is as cranks, as sort of cult members. You know, I remember one commentator comparing them to the followers of Charles Manson. There's been a sense that it should be something to be ashamed of to support Jeremy Corbyn. And so what has happened as a result of that is that there's been a kind of culture around him that's grown up around him, particularly around his young supporters, where they have their own vernacular. Their nickname for him is the absolute boy, because it's a kind of ironic because he's so unladdish, that they kind of use lad jargon. They call anybody who doesn't like him a slug. You know, so they have all of these like particular words. And it's really a symptom of the fact that they've developed their own sort of culture, which I think is an act of defiance against the negativity about him. It's a way of transforming something that they've been made to feel shameful about into an identity, into a source of pride. But I think the underlying support for Corbyn is because of his policies, because, you know, young people are so tired of not having secure housing, not having secure work, that kind of thing. And that was the initial driver for the support. But then following that, the shame that they were made to feel for supporting him has been transformed into this kind of identity that is really a statement of defiance. That's my explanation for it.
I think also for him to be at Glastonbury is entirely appropriate. I mean, Glastonbury, if you look at the history of the festival in the early 80s, when Glastonbury was sponsored by C&D for the first time and was really revitalised from having been a sort of slightly hippie-ish backwater into something very vibrant and enormous, it was very associated with the left. You know, Glastonbury's had a long association with this kind of libertarian leftism. Corbyn's not the first.
I suppose the argument against it might be, and I was actually wondering, if I was an advisor to Corbyn, would you say to go or not? The argument against it is, it costs over £200 for a ticket. It is really quite an elite thing to go to now, because frankly, who can afford over £200 for a ticket? And Corbyn has done this amazing thing in the election. And do you want it to look like, symbolically, it is a load of very affluent liberal people who have carried him? Or do you want it to look like it's a broader base? I mean, that's just what I was thinking in terms of, you know, if it's symbolic in a good or a bad way. But I suppose Ali's right. Not only does it reach the 200,000 people there, it reaches millions of people on television.
And I think we have to be quite careful about how we characterise people that go to Glastonbury. I mean, I've not been there for a few years, but, you know, some people just save up the 200 quid. And the reason it costs 200 quid is because of the policing costs. It's not the Glastonbury organisers who want it to be very expensive. When I first used to go about 8,000 years ago, it cost about 50 quid to go. And that's because there was less policing. So it's
not saying it's not worth it. I'm just saying most people can't afford it.
I think, though, if you look at, like, you know, I grew up in a working class community, and lots of the people that I grew up with would go on holidays to places like Magaluf and Ibiza, and they would end up spending way more than £250. I think it's not that £250 is too much for a holiday. I just think it's like the idea of being a hippie and what eating falafel and camping for the weekend is sort of seen as a middle class thing. But actually, in my experience, Glastonbury has a much broader swathe of the population than one might think from the commentary around it.
Okay, and Sean, are the Tories really worried about Jeremy Corbyn now?
I'm not sure they're massively worried. I think there's a lot of confusion about why he was supported in such large numbers. Because the Tory party, remember, got its biggest share of the vote since, I think it was 1983.
Share of the working class vote.
Yeah, a record share of working class vote. And there were a lot of people that switched from the Tories to Labour, actually, in the kind of middle class areas. And I think the question on their minds now, and they're waiting for, there's data coming out soon from British Election Study and other places, other polls. Did people vote for him en masse because they thought, as Ellie said, you know, the media panned him so much that he's not going to win, so let's give the government a bit of a kicking over austerity or Brexit or something, and then let's vote for him? Or was there something more fundamentally wrong, as Andy suggested earlier, with the Tory party's prospectus for people? And I imagine it's probably a bit of both, because it was very difficult for people to say, after the Thursday polling day, what is life going to be like on Friday onwards? And with Corbyn, you knew they're going to spend a load more money on all this stuff. I don't know if the sums add up, but this is what they're going to do. Tories, no idea, really. They're saying about Brexit and social care and other things, and it was all a bit of a mess. So I think it's probably a bit of both.
I think also we have to look at the coalition that supported Corbyn. I mean, I think if Corbyn had just got young voters and kind of lefty sort of liberal diehards like me, that would have been a 30% strategy. But he got 40%. And I think concentrating on the Tory vote share misses the story that the Labour vote share was the biggest, you know, since 1997. So, or maybe 2001, enormous for a left-wing manifesto. And I think a lot of old Labour voters, working class voters, particularly in the North, in the end broke for Labour in a way that the Tories were not expecting, because they like things like nationalisation. And that's a problem for the Tories, that Corbyn's got a populist appeal to quite traditional working class people that they didn't anticipate.
And Ellie, he obviously did brilliantly and is now, you know, firmly in place, but he didn't win. And the last time someone didn't win, stayed in place, was Neil Kinnock. He went on to lose. What does Jeremy have to do to go on to win?
Jeremy just needs to keep doing what he's doing. He's great at campaigning. He's great on the stump. I think that's what swung it for him. You know, I think that, you know, it wasn't going very well. It did turn around in that 6 weeks. And that's because when he's in campaign mode, he's on fire. And I think, and that is what I understand Labour are planning on doing now, being in permanent campaign mode. And I think that's the right thing to do.
Fantastic. Thank you all very much. Now, finally this week, as new MPs find their feet and defeated members clear out, there is another class of MP, those who are returning to the Commons after defeat just 2 years ago. Our reporter Jessica Elgar met a couple of them.
Chris Ruan, Labour MP for the Vale of Clwyd.
So, Chris, you you lost your seat in 2015 and you won it back a couple of weeks ago. What's it been like coming back? What was it like on your first day back?
It was amazing. It was surreal. I did not expect to be back in this place in such a short timescale. And I won't have a word said against Mrs. May, my patron and benefactor, who brought me back to this place. Thank you, Mrs. May.
Take us back to 2015 and the lead up to losing your seat. What was that like in the constituency? Because you've been there for 18 years. You've been there a long time.
I've been there for 18 years, and one of the things I'm proud that I did in that 18 years was to set up a mindfulness practice in Parliament for 150 MPs and peers. And it benefited me tremendously in that quite crunch time after the election where I lost. There's nothing as X as an ex-MP. You know, 1 minute you've got the status, the kudos, you can write letters on parliamentary headed note paper, people pay attention to you. The next thing, you're unemployed. And it's a big distance to go. But my mindfulness practice and my gratitude practice kept me well balanced, I believe. And also, I'm grateful to my friends in the cross-party group. They made me honorary president of the all-party mindfulness group. And I then went on to visit parliaments around the world and helped to establish mindfulness practices for those politicians. So for the past 2 years, I've been spreading peace and goodwill around the world.
Tell us a bit more about those groups that you set up in different parliaments.
Yeah, well, I was doing it in Parliament as well when I was an MP. So I went across to the Dutch Parliament and helped to establish a group there. I worked on a cross-party basis with a Conservative Assembly member, Darren Miller, to set up mindfulness practice in the Welsh Assembly. I went out to the Australian Parliament, to Canada, to France 3 times, and they're about to set up their practice group now just after the French elections, and the Germans set up a group in January. Overall, over the past 2 years, I've been dealing with mindfulness advocates in 40 different countries that want to take mindfulness practice to their politicians and furthermore develop public policy in health, education, prison systems and the workplace. So it's been it's been quite a nice time, actually, and I would recommend it to my colleagues to have an enforced sabbatical every now and again.
Stephen Lloyd, Lib Dem Member of Parliament for Eastbourne and Willingdon.
So you lost your seat in 2015, and when the election was called, how quickly did you decide that you wanted to stand again for Parliament?
Well, it's slightly more complicated than that, because I only lost by 1.5%. In 2015, a lot of people in the town were very sweet. They kind of immediately said, I have to restand, this is awful, Stephen, if we had known we would have voted. So there was quite a lot of emotion flying around, which was very touching, but as you can imagine, also quite stressful. I was in a bizarre situation, having just lost by a whisker, of having to comfort an awful lot of people who hadn't voted, and to comfort them with a smile, bless them. Anyway, what I did is I didn't decide to stand straight away. I went back into business. I have a huge mortgage to pay. Someone, and it honestly wasn't me, and it honestly wasn't us, started a big petition to demand that Stephen Lloyd re-stand. And I crossed my heart, hope to die. It wasn't me. It wasn't us. It wasn't any Liberals. And I kind of, that built momentum a lot, and I was very flattered, and I'd given it a lot of thought. I needed a year break to decide whether I still had the passion, because you have to. I mean, your listeners who don't live in Eastbourne may know, but those who do will know that Eastbourne isn't just my passion. It was, you know, 7 days a week full on. I loved the job, I loved the town, and I needed to make sure I still had that in me. I also wanted a year delay to see whether the town still wanted me back. It would have been terribly embarrassing if I said, I'm coming back, folks, and they said, nah, we've moved on. 5 months later, Theresa May calls a snap election, and I'm back a little sooner than I expected, and it's a privilege to be back. And, well, Lloydie's back, and I'm delighted for me, and I'm delighted for my town. They've really stepped up, and what can I say? But there is nothing on the planet that I enjoy more than being Eastbourne's MP. I know that sounds cheesy, Jess, I understand that. But it's true, I just absolutely love it.
Jessica Elgott reporting there, and that is all we have time for. My thanks to all my guests this week, and to Sean Worth, Andy Beckett and Ellie May O'Hagan, and to Andy Haldane for taking me on a day trip. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Anoushka Astana. Thanks for listening.